From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a time when politics in this country wasn't so polarized. It's hard to imagine it now, but it wasn't that long ago when there wasn't the kind of partisan warfare we've become so used to. The political scientist Sam Rosenfeld is our guest today, and he says the way we came to this modern polarization was a deliberate effort by a group of activists, and it worked. Join us after this.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his book, The Polarizers, Sam Rosenfeld says, in the middle of the 20th century, there were historically high levels of bipartisanship in government. The political parties in those days were kind of weak. But he says, as we began the 21st century, we came to see levels of partisan discord in Congress unseen, he says, since the Gilded Age. Gridlock and bickering personified probably by the current government shutdown. So what changed and how did we get here? That's what Rosenfeld has been exploring in his work, figuring out how this system where you have liberals in one party and conservatives in another party, how that came to define American politics. He says that if we can understand how we deliberately created this system of dysfunctional politics, maybe we can deliberately change it. Though don't hold your breath. He's not all that hopeful about that part. The book, again, The Polarizers, Post-War Architects of the Partisan Era. Sam Rosenfeld is an assistant professor of political science at Colgate University, joining us today from the studios of member station WAER in Syracuse, New York. And Professor, welcome to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin with what got you thinking about all of this, the idea of how the system used to be and how we've transformed it. When did you start really looking and digging into all of this?
It was before I even decided to go into academia. I was a journalist in the mid-aughts, George W. Bush era, yeah. In D.C., working for a opinion political magazine. And I was tasked as, you know, a 22-year-old to cover Congress. And this was, I can show my cards here, this was a liberal magazine. And so I was sort of tasked with covering how much Democrats, who were in the minority at the time in Congress, were getting marginalized and excluded from lawmaking and generally abused, et cetera. And in doing that, I was reading up on Congress and congressional history and learning about sort of developments in Congress of the kind of evolution of more disciplined and partisan centralized leadership and the rise of sort of party line voting. Associating it because I was tasked with kind of looking at how much Democrats were victimized, associating it with Newt Gingrich and Tom DeLay, if you remember Tom DeLay, the hammer from back in that era.
Right.
But what I came to realize reading some historical work is that the environment that Republicans were capitalizing on and using to advance a partisan agenda and exclude Democrats from participating in was in fact created by reforms that were advocated by and then implemented by liberal Democrats back in the late 1960s and 1970s. Congressional reforms that served to diminish the independent authority of congressional committees and undermine the seniority system, which the norm that had determined leadership in committees by strict seniority, and instead sort of centralized power in party leaders and empowered the party caucuses, the rank and file as a whole, to vote for who would be on running committees, et cetera. It was liberal Democrats who forged that system that serve to, over the next few decades, trigger or sort of mobilize a rise in partisan voting and behavior in Congress. And I got interested in what were these liberal Democrats thinking. And the more I looked, the more I thought, well, actually, they had a good case for what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
And from there, you go back and back, and you can see a lot of the kind of intellectual buttressing for this set of reforms back into an earlier era in the 1940s and 1950s.
We'll get into the quote-unquote good case that you mentioned as we go along. But what do you mean by the polarizers, just as a term, this idea of – because that's what they were thinking of. I mean, they didn't think of polarization as being necessarily a bad thing, that there were small-d democratic elements built into this idea of polarization, I think.
Absolutely. And the polarizers is my word, not theirs.
Of course. And
that's a word that's everywhere right now, but it has kind of multiple meanings. I think
right.
when a lot of people think of polarization, they think of a lack of civility, of decline in kind of discord, rising discord, a decline in civil discourse in politics that I think is epitomized by the current administration and what's going on right now. You can also think of it in terms of a move to the ideological extremes on the left and right. What I'm getting at when I talk about polarization is the sorting of the two political parties by ideology.
Yeah.
In a way that the party system in the middle of the 20th century was definitively not. The party system in the 21st century is pretty cleanly organized by and sorted by ideology, where, again, in Congress, you can see this through – because they vote so much that you can measure these things. And political scientists and others have shown that the most liberal member of the Republican Party in Congress is still more conservative than the most conservative Democrat in Congress. So there's no overlap in that way. So that's that's what I mean by polarization. It doesn't even necessarily have to mean that people are moving to the extremes, and it's the kind of tone and political cultural changes are byproducts of a more deeper structural change in which the political parties used to be organized around other things, and now they're organized around ideology and agenda.
Yeah. And they're just basically organized, or more organized than they used to be. Let's start with Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, he wasn't the only one who had this idea, of course, and we'll talk about the others, but it's a pretty good place to start. Talk about how in 1944, as you write about, Roosevelt says, I don't know if it was an offhanded comment, but he says to an aide, hey, we need to have two real parties. And first of all, explain what he meant by that, because as you were alluding to before, in those days, the 1940s and the mid part of the 20th century, we didn't have these two distinct parties. Talk about what it was like in those days.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the New Deal and Roosevelt's long administration, long tenure in office, is really key to all of this, because it's during the Great Depression and the sort of set of policies that come to be associated with Roosevelt and the New Deal, that you get what we would recognize as a kind of modern liberal programmatic agenda for government activism, particularly in the economy. That emerges at a time when the Democratic Party, for historical reasons, has a huge empowered bloc, especially in Congress, in sort of nominating systems, et cetera, in the South, the solid South of kind of white supremacist Jim Crow era.
Yeah.
South is right. solidly Democratic, and those are Roosevelt's partners in passing any of the New Deal legislation. And by the late 1930s, Roosevelt is getting frustrated, especially he gets reelected by a larger landslide than he first got elected in 1936. And it's in that second term when he starts to feel or encounter real resistance in Congress, not only by Republicans, but by conservative Southern Democrats who are starting to kind of institutionalize a coalition with Republicans that comes to be called the Conservative Coalition that hampers Roosevelt's agenda on reorganizing the Supreme Court. They watered down the Fair Labor Standards Act after delaying it for a while. And that causes Roosevelt much frustration. He decides in 1938 to try and purge the Democratic Party in Congress of these anti-New Deal conservatives by actively campaigning for liberal primary challengers in the South that famously didn't work. he didn't knock any of them off. And then by 1944, late in his presidency, he is still feeling this frustration, and he tells Harry Hopkins this. It was an offhand comment, but it was in the process of reaching out to Wendell Willkie, his moderate Republican presidential opponent from 1940, to try and kind of orchestrate from the top down a realignment of the parties in which Willkie would call for his kind of progressive and moderate Republican supporters to join forces with him and Roosevelt, leaving the conservative wings of both parties to somehow organize themselves into a political party as well. That was the kind of dream early on. You know, Wendell Willkie was responsive to this, but then he promptly died that fall. So it's a big what if as to if they had tried to pull like something like this off. Roosevelt, of course, died shortly thereafter.
And what happens to the plan? Is it? I mean, it's a secret plan that he's trying to enact. What happens to it? Just seems like it just sort of goes fallow for several decades, I guess.
It does indeed. Yeah, I mean, it goes fallow in the sense of there was no one like no one with the stature and the power that Roosevelt had as president succeeding him. And to more to the point, had he attempted to go public with this and pull it off, I don't think he would have. Part of the story I tell in this book is that I think a more generalizable fact about politics is that it's engaged movements, groups, and activists kind of in the thick of party politics and ancillary political organizations that over time can bring about major structural change. And so I would say that the Roosevelt dream dies with him in its kind of top-down form. But over the next few decades, during a period in which the actual lawmaking, the political culture is defined by this huge degree of ideological diversity and heterogeneity in both parties, you have activists on both the left and right, elected officials, but also union leaders, intellectuals, writers, political scientists even, who are dissatisfied with the state of things in the same way that Roosevelt was, and who go about pursuing both factional battles and institutional reforms to change the system.
So I want to talk about the good and the bad of this era when there was a lot of bipartisanship going on. The good parts first, I guess. You mentioned how there was this real sense of camaraderie, which you hear a lot of people hearkening back to. And you've written about Joe Biden talking about the days when you could have a good stiff argument and then go have a good stiff drink with somebody. And there's also something that Democrat Sam Rayburn said, and I think this was in 1955, about the Dwight Eisenhower, you know, the Republican administration. He talked about kindliness. Talked about, look, he's the leader of our country, and we're not going to oppose it just because he's a Republican, which sounds just like impossible when you think about today, right? Mitch McConnell saying exactly the opposite sort of thing when Barack Obama is elected. So I guess that's part of the good. That's part of the good sense of it. But and also, by the way, along that line was good legislation getting passed? Were they actually governing? Were good things happening?
Yeah. I mean, you're already getting at shades of bad and the good, I think, with that question. Because, I mean, one thing, Biden was recalling, and in fine Biden fashion, he kind of said all this explicitly. He was wistfully thinking back to the days when you could You were in. He was in the same, because he came to the Senate in 1972, so he's been around for a while. And he had colleagues, he said, like Sam Eastland, a Southern white supremacist, segregationist. Yeah. Yeah. And he was recalling, you know, we were in the same party and we could fight over legislation, but we were also comrades, et cetera, which does offer a hint at one of the kind of structural underpinnings of the mid-century era in which the parties were not ideologically well-sorted at all is the fact that Southern Democrats remained Democrats during a period in which that party dominated the South based on Jim Crow, white supremacy, yeah. and disenfranchisement of African Americans. Right. So on the one hand, during this era, what you don't have are recurrent government shutdowns for no particularly good reason. You have much less of the kind of brittle, always on the cusp of breakdown kind of dysfunctions in the gears of governing that seem to be kind of recurrent features of the current system. And I think there are sort of institutional reasons for why that's the case. Mm-hmm. And all of that is good. On the other hand, and you had plenty of lawmaking happening. So famously, David Mayhew is a political scientist at Yale who wrote a book in 1990 called Divided We Govern, in which he built a data set of legislative productivity, kind of major laws passed in each Congress going back to the beginning of the Eisenhower administration. And he found, contrary to what you might expect, that divided government, when one party controls the presidency and the other party controls one or both chambers of Congress, versus unified government, makes no difference in terms of the legislative productivity yeah. during that era. That's different now.
It must be incredibly different now, right?
Yes, yeah. yes. Divided government these days, you can get, you know, we just got to that criminal, you could get sort of moments of legislative breakthrough, but much more stasis and then combined with shutdowns and crises. Anyway, so lawmaking was happening.
Yeah.
The kind of – and this was part of the frustration of especially liberal Democrats but also conservative Republicans – the kind of policies that would get passed reflected typically reflected a kind of incrementalism,
yeah.
Bargaining stemming from log rolls in Congress where you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You pass my bill, I'll pass yours. And major kind of cohesive what we would think of in terms as being ideological or programmatically coherent policies typically didn't get passed,
yeah.
except for these very extraordinary circumstances like the Great Depression and the New Deal, and then a kind of period of after John F. Kennedy's assassination and then Lyndon Johnson's landslide election in 1964, this kind of big bang of policy that came in the with the Great Society Congress. Those are exceptions. The typical kind of lawmaking that was happening during this time was much less in the realm of big major breakthroughs creating big new social programs. And that's part of what frustrated, yeah. Aside from there were liberals who wanted more action on civil rights and saw the arrangements of the parties as an obstacle to that. And these same liberals also wanted to kind of, from their mind, fulfill the social democratic promises of the New Deal in terms of social and economic legislation, and wanted a more coherent disciplined party system to carry that out.
Well, it also seems like you say most lawmaking in those days was carried out by these coalitions. So it seems like a lot of backroom deals going on. So it doesn't seem like it was terribly transparent in those days or terribly democratic, small d.
Absolutely.
And you've also talked about how the party system in those days, in fact, this is how you put it in your book, it served to muzzle rather than clarify disagreements. Talk about that part. I think that's really interesting. Like and I guess this was one of the frustrations of the intellectuals looking at this system is this is not a terribly democratic system at play.
Absolutely. I mean, there is in part sort of driving some of the changes structurally that leads to a more sorted and polarized system is the rise of new groups of people, starting with African Americans, but then demanding political voice and inclusion, the rise of new issues that were excluded from this mid-century era, issues related to culture, gender, identity, et cetera. At the time, we're talking about a system in which norms of transparency are nothing like what we see now, what we would consider democratically appropriate. And it was white and male and quite clubby. That was part of the bonhomie you saw in the political culture is how relatively insular and insulated from popular participation routine politics was. More broadly, the kind of political science critique that comes out of this is the small d democratic critique they made of bipartisanship at the levels we saw in the mid-century was twofold. They thought, you know, parties exist in part to offer voters who are busy and paying attention to other things in their lives cues as to which side they should choose, what direction they want the country to go in. And a system that was in which all the legislation is done on a bipartisan basis, in which the two parties, in terms of their platforms and their agendas, are rather fuzzy and indistinct, robbed voters of a meaningful substantive choice at the ballot box. It then meant that come the next election,
who do you hold responsible, right?
Exactly. Voters didn't have a sense of who to hold collectively accountable and responsible for policy outcomes. So that kind of fuzziness, the argument went, robbed voters of meaningful choice and meaningful mechanisms of accountability.
So I guess it's important to say what you've mentioned. It's not as if people, of course, didn't disagree like they do now. We weren't all holding hands in those days. We still disagreed. We still had ideologies. It's just that they weren't built into the party system the way they are now, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, if you want to see toxic political culture and an uncivil discourse, right in the middle of this bipartisan system is the McCarthy era, Joe McCarthy, the Red Scare of the late 1940s and early 1950s, sort of venomous, personal, destructive political attacks. But it was not organized and structured by the party system. So in a broader sense, it ends up being the interaction of parties that have become more organized and disciplined and centralized in their authority because they now consist more and more of people that agree with one another, organizing all political decisions in a set of American political institutions that was forged in a Constitution 1787 that is deliberately quite fragmented and a kind of obstacle course to getting anything done unless you can get majorities in two chambers of Congress as well as the presidency at the same time, et cetera, and putting these kind of disciplined parties into a system like that is we have discovered a recipe for some dysfunction.
Yeah. Well, when we get back from a break, we'll start talking about some of the particular polarizers, some of the intellectuals who really transformed this system. It's the basis of Sam Rosenfeld's book, which is called The Polarizers, Postwar Architects of Our Partisan Era. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Have you added a new smart speaker to your home? They're amazing, right? In fact, you can make your Amazon Echo, Google Home, or Apple HomePod even smarter. Ask it to play KUER. Your digital assistant will serve up our live stream filled with the latest news and brain-expanding shows like Marketplace, Radiolab, and All Things Considered. To find out more about how to use your smart speaker, go to KUER.org and click on How to Listen. Or just tell your device to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a time when politics in this country wasn't so polarized. And it's hard to imagine now, but it wasn't that long ago when there wasn't the kind of partisan warfare we've become so used to. No gridlock. No, there was actual compromise between the two parties, actual governing going on. The political scientist Sam Rosenfeld is our guest today, and he says not everything about this era of getting along was so good. And so there were some intellectuals who really transformed that system. They became, as he puts it, the post-war architects of this partisan era. That's the subtitle to his book called The Polarizers. And Sam Rosenfeld is joining us today to talk about it. So let's talk about, Sam, some of these thinkers. I guess we could start with this man named, I have to confess, I didn't know anything about E.E. Schatzschneider. Really good name. And he's one of these dissatisfied intellectuals. And he's a proponent of this doctrine, you should explain, the responsible party government idea. Talk a little bit about him and where he fits in the story.
Absolutely. So Schatzschneider, people called him Schott, his friends, was a political scientist at Wesleyan University in Connecticut for his whole career. He's not a household name, but in political science, in American political science, he's a kind of towering figure, I would say, of the 20th century. And he personally was this just extremely charismatic intellectual kind of leader. People flocked to him as a kind of school of thought, particularly at this time. And what he did first in a book he wrote called Party Government in 1942, and then in the later 1940s as the head of a American Political Science Association committee on political parties that gets organized, is revive a doctrine called responsible party government, which is actually originally formulated by Woodrow Wilson. Prior to becoming president, he was himself a political scientist in the late 19th century, and a real kind of Anglophile supporter of the Westminster system, the parliamentary system in Great Britain. And the bottom line is proponents of responsible parties use the word responsible in the way we were getting at before about kind of accountability. They want – the parties needed to be internally cohesive and disciplined so that they could take collective responsibility for government policy and could be held collectively responsible for the policies that were made. And it's the New Deal context, the rise of the conservative coalition that – leads to Roosevelt's frustration and then leads to the frustration of liberal Democrats, particularly in the North, who are growing in power within the Democratic Party because they're growing in numbers, but who see their agenda kind of stalled by this bipartisan conservative coalition and who see their major factional enemies as these Southern Democrats who, due to seniority, have disproportionate clout in Congress. They also take as their factional enemies the kind of last remaining patronage-driven machine party bosses in urban enclaves in the industrial North who, again, organize political behavior and activism around transactional relationships and kind of material incentives through patronage rather than ideas about what the federal government should be doing in healthcare or pensions or economic regulation.
Idealistic, right? I mean, based on these deep the integrity and principles.
Yeah, I mean, and they wanted parties that were not just disciplined and differentiated from one another, but also defined by policy agendas. They wanted distinct politics and parties, they write in the committee's report that they put out in 1950, should be party agendas should be defined in terms of policy and the use of government. And so that's this report they put out called Toward a More Responsible Two-Party System in 1950 is the kind of thing that scholarly associations, certainly political scientists, don't do as much of anymore. There was a presumption that if political scientists said some stuff about government, that people might listen and think they have special expertise. Yeah. To be declaiming in this way. And at the time, it caused, I would argue, it caused a splash. It certainly caused a great degree of controversy within the discipline of political science. But it also, the arguments and the ideas and the language used in that report provided a language for activists in real politics on the ground to make critiques of the existing system. Yeah. And you started to see that in sort of reform movements for with respect to Congress, later to with respect to the convention and presidential nominating system. And earlier than that, in the 1950s, in battles that happen at the state level in various Northern Democratic parties, you see the rise of more better educated and more issue-driven, issue-oriented Democratic activists who take over a lot of state Democratic parties that had been either in a state of total atrophy or still being run along patronage-fueled machine terms.
So it wasn't the eggheads like Schott who were transforming this ultimately. I mean, maybe they came up with the idea, but the people that were really making it work were the actual activists on the ground? They were the ones that were really helping to transform it?
I think that's right. Although one of the many reasons why the Democratic Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota remains such an amazing source of fascination to me and some other scholars is there. That's the party that Hubert Humphrey builds with others over the course of the middle of the 20th century. And Hubert Humphrey he was mayor of Minneapolis, and then he became a senator, and then of course vice president. But he also had a master's in political science, and all of his kind of closest political aides throughout his career were political scientists at the University of Minnesota, all of whom themselves subscribed to this kind of responsible party theory. So Humphrey is someone who, as a young freshman senator, is giving speeches after this political science report comes out in which he's explicitly calling for, you know, responsible parties. But that kind of scholar activist model is more rare than, generally speaking, people getting involved in politics because they're passionate about certain issues or a kind of New Deal liberal ethos on the liberal side, and they start to critique the existing system using language that comes from these intellectuals and political scientists.
So you have people like Michael Harrington and Heather Booth on the Democratic side who are doing all their activist work within the party now. And then the same thing is happening when this gets us to the conservative side of all of this. The same thing is happening in the GOP. You have the Christian right, for example, that starts to get connected to the Republican Party, which is one of the big reasons why Reagan becomes elected. So talk a little bit about if Democrats are frustrated, I guess conservatives are too. They also want their own party. They don't want liberal Republicans in their party. And so talk a little bit about this strain. I guess the intellectuals who started the National Review are part of this group.
Yeah. On both sides, I would say, and this is, again, I think generalizable, engaged activists tend to think that they're speaking on behalf of a majority out there just waiting to be mobilized, right? Yeah. So liberals, up to and including people like Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, have this sense of, well, look, the people keep electing New Deal Democrats to the presidency. They want big, bold, New Deal-style liberal activist legislation, and we're being hampered by this cabal of conservative Republicans and this rump dissident faction of Southern Democrats. Conservatives, particularly in the Eisenhower years, in the 1950s, have the opposite sense. They think we're being they're very frustrated, and this is a defining frustration for William F. Buckley and the other founders of the National Review. They're frustrated with the moderate, accommodationist, pragmatic presidency of Eisenhower, who deliberately does not try to kind of roll back any of the major liberal advances of the 1930s. Right. And they have a sense of there is a conservative constitutionalist majority out in the country that is being excluded by this kind of liberal consensus that's dominating things. And so there's competing visions of what the majority is out there and where sentiment is. And so William F. Buckley is a young kind of rabble-rouser at Yale and writer and journalist, and he forms with a set of other intellectuals, including a political scientist named Wilmore Kendall, the National Review, and is offering a critique of bipartisanship and Republican accommodation to Democratic and liberal policies and ideology that generally doesn't use the same responsible party language, although you see it sometimes. And they were much less connected to the mainstream of responsible party political scientists, most of whom were themselves liberal Democrats, but is essentially coming to the same conclusion that there's a problem with this rampant bipartisanship that a more ideologically sorted party system could help solve. Yeah. By the time you get to, you know, you go through the maelstrom of cultural and political tumults of the 1960s, the emergence of a whole set of new issues over culture and race identity to national political salience. In the 1970s, you get the emergence of what's called the new right in American conservatism, of people who emphasize, activists especially, but some elected officials like Jesse Helms, who comes to the Senate in 1972, who are emerging in part, or they're building their political success in the West as well as in a realigning South, and they emphasize these new cultural issues, all the while maintaining a kind of conservative anti-tax, anti-labor economic agenda. And they inject into American politics, you know, preceding Reagan, but culminating with Reagan's election in 1980, a much more sort of aggressive, combative, partisan approach. There's a rejection. Newt Gingrich is famously associated with this, and he comes to Congress in 1978, a rejection of norms of let's get along, let's have drinks after this bill. We're Republicans in Congress. Yes, we're in the minority, but if we work with our Democratic colleagues, we can get some, you know, policy buy-in and concessions on various bills. A rejection of all that, and an ethos of pursuing politics as a permanent combat.
Which gets us to, as you track in the book, where we are now, where the parties today are more cohesive, more distinct, more powerful even, I suppose, than almost ever before. So mission accomplished, I guess, M. Rosenfeld, these intellectuals and these activists, they transform the system. But you write about what they got wrong and what they got right, I suppose. Let's talk about what they got wrong. Two big problems, you say. One of them is the institution. Institutionally, they didn't account for the potential for gridlock, I suppose. I mean, talk about this first part, how they got this. They underestimated the system, I guess, the institution part.
Right. One important context is divided government was just historically a much rarer occurrence in the period in which these political scientists especially were doing their work in the first half of the 20th century. It was just much more normal for one party to win control of Congress at the same time they won the presidency. Presidential parties typically lost votes in midterm elections, but it usually didn't flip control of Congress. It's a phenomenon of the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st, in which very frequently we have periods of divided government. They advocated for parliamentary style disciplined parties. Parliamentary systems, party discipline is the, kind of the essence of the entire system. And the if you're not part of the governing coalition, if you're in the opposition, you have no you're not participating in lawmaking at all. You're just voting no on everything and building your case for the next election. They envision parties like that in the American system with the assumption that most of the time one party would be in control. So yeah. One party could, in fact, be held collectively responsible for any policy they made.
That's not how parties, it works here.
It's not for a variety of contingent reasons, it's not how outcomes happen in contemporary American elections. Right. And that just means during divided government, having these very disciplined, substantively distinct and hostile to one another parties control co-equal parts of the government at once is a real problem.
Yeah.
They also – so that they just – that was, I think, a blind spot, although it would be hard to have predicted. Along those lines, though, even during periods of unified control, their assumption – and certainly Schatzschneider's view of this was the – political system, the institutions set up by the Constitution and the kind of internal workings of institutions like Congress, they can change in the face of strong parties. They have changed in the past. The whole office of the presidency and the power of the presidency is a product and part of the emergence of political parties in the first place, which kind of undermined the original rationale of the Electoral College. Congressional reform, which ends up happening in the 70s, is a good example of parties remaking the internal workings of Congress in a way that could better empower partisan organization. The assumption was that process would proceed more easily than it ended up proceeding.
Yeah.
A good example is the filibuster, which is not in the Constitution. It's not any kind of law. It's an internal rule in the Senate that was there by historical accident in the 19th century and had become by the middle of the 20th century a tool for minority obstruction, particularly around at the hands of Southern Democrats around civil rights legislation, but not just that. That was considered a real violation of the norm of responsible parties by these people. These political scientists advocated for doing away with the filibuster, restoring majority rule as the internal norm in the Senate, and they assumed that that would be a part of the package of reforming American political parties. Instead, what happened was, as the parties got more sorted, mm-hmm. as the system became more ideologically polarized, minority parties felt more and more compelled to use any tool at their disposal to stop what they considered to be bad policy from getting implemented.
Right.
And so along – at the very same time that the parties are getting more themselves, quote unquote, responsible and ideologically sorted and disciplined, you get a huge increase, an exponential increase in the later decades of the 20th century and especially in the 21st century of the use of the filibuster for everything, not just certain specialized issues where a minority feels intensely, but it became a routine supermajority requirement in the Senate to pass anything. That's very hard to do. That's hard to – you don't see that in any other – democratic political system in the world, and it's very rare for one party to have such numbers that they can supersede a 60-vote threshold. It happens every once in a while, and again, it kind of grinds down the gears of the system in a way that leads to much more obstruction and dysfunction than they had anticipated institutionally.
The other part they got wrong, you mentioned, is the psychological part. They underestimated, you say, just how driven we can all be by groupthink and tribalism and kind of revenge. It's like they hadn't accounted for the ugly sides of human nature in some ways.
Yeah, I think that's right. This is much more the domain of what we call behavioralists in American political science, people who study the political psychology, what makes people tick, informing their voting decisions, but also what makes political elites tick. But there was a sense that if you could make the parties more logically organized around agendas, you would introduce more logic and coherence to the political system. They had, a vision of politics as a kind of high-minded debating society, and that the problem as of the middle of the 20th century is that lots of voters and lots of politicians were being motivated by other things, patronage or just, voting the way your family or your community votes, et cetera. They wanted to introduce more logic and coherence into the system. But, you know, it turns out
we like that incoherence, I guess, as voters, right? That's who we are.
Exactly. There's an enormous now, and it's a ever-growing industry of behavioral work and political science and political psychology that illustrates just how prone to motivated reasoning, to tribalism is a word people are throwing around a lot, teamsmanship, voters, how much of that motivates the behavior of voters.
Voters voting against their interest, for example, you hear that a lot, as opposed to voting in sort of logical ways. They're more inclined you hear this, I'm not sure how true it is or fair it might be, but you're hearing that some Republicans in certain places might be voting against their interests just because they're worried about immigrants. Like, it's nationalism that's driving everything, not their economic interests, for example.
Yeah, I mean, and then it depends on what you define as someone else's interests.
True.
In part, a lot of the work. I mean, if you apply some strict material interest kind of rationale, you can see irrationality rampantly in voter behavior. But also, a lot of times people don't have, or there's good evidence that shows people develop their interests or their positions on issues as a result of taking cues from party leaders and party elites rather than the other way around. They're not choosing their party to match their positions. They're choosing their positions to match their party. And that just is as you said, a feature of human nature. People are group-oriented. They're identity-driven. And that's a huge part of politics. And it just turns out, again, if you take those innate features of political behavior and combine it with parties that actually do, when it comes to brass tacks policy, mm-hmm. have much more divergent and less overlapping interests and agendas than they used to, and much more powerful tools of internal discipline and organization, the tribalism and the, the ill will is amplified rather than mitigated. And so there's good work now on what's called negative partisanship. Stephen Webster and Alan Abramowitz have written about this, where one of the defining features driving polarization at the mass level right now is people actually don't feel any warmer or fuzzier towards their own party than they ever have, if you look at survey data, but they feel much, much worse, much, much more energized in a negative way when it comes to how they feel about the other party.
So what you're saying, and we're running out of time here, so I want to get to sort of, you don't come to a tidy conclusion here, but it seems like what you're saying is maybe we embrace this polarization. As you say sort of finally in the book, progressives have no choice but to get back into the thick of it. So this idea of activism, because you don't find any great solution, frankly, for gridlock. I mean, you don't have some soft and fuzzy ending here. And what you're saying is we just need to dig in. This is where we are. It seems like that's what you're saying, and I'm hoping I'm not getting that wrong. But say something about that finally, because what you seem to be suggesting is it may be impossible to reverse engineer this at this point, and we should just maybe embrace it in some way.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is I hope the book offers reason to see that major structural changes that occurred over several decades at the hands of these activists and architects that I point to, they were done for a reason.
Yeah.
Particularly wishing for people to kind of no longer affiliate with a party with which they might share beliefs, or to kind of, as you say, reverse engineer substantive agendas out of the kind of party alignments, is not something I find credible. I don't know what other basis in a modern era in which patronage machines are gone and how you would organize parties. What I would say institutionally is a lot of the effort is to they see an ill fit. People see an ill fit between how parties behave and how the political system is set up. And the instinct is to try to make the parties behave differently. I still take a cue from E. Schatzschneider and from those thinkers of the time to say, actually, you are in better shape attempting to change the system to accommodate polarized disciplined parties more effectively. So again, the filibuster, that is a institution that can be changed at any moment by a party that controls the Senate. And what that would do is, to be clear, not if anything, it would enhance polarization. It would make polarization. Yeah. It would allow for a given party, when they are in control, to do more things and to do more things on a more partisan basis. But it would help solve the problem of a kind of entrenched regular dysfunction and gridlock, which is all to say that there are these trade-offs in sort of what you're, what goals you're looking for.
Sam Rosenfeld, his book is The Polarizers, Postwar Architects of Our Partisan Era. He is an assistant professor of political science at Colgate University, joined us from the studio of member station WAER in Syracuse, New York. Professor, thank you very much for taking the time.
This was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Radio West is a production of KUWER News, technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.